Looking for exciting video content live and on demand? Visit www.voiceamerica.tv for exclusive content you just can't find anywhere else. That's voiceamerica.tv. Tune in now.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Mind, Brain, and Body with Dr. Michael John Kell. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the host, guest, and callers. Now helping you live a more productive and fulfilling life, Dr. Michael John Kell.
Hey, good morning. I'm roaming the world as usual, working on my new book about romance in women and the wonders of knowing females and some of the problems, too. But today we're going to be talking about a subject very dear to me, which is dealing with alcoholism. And, you know, most of you know, I've listened to the show for a long time, is that for a long time I was a psychiatrist. Well, I guess I'm still a psychiatrist, but it's been a long time dealing with alcoholism and, you know, what to do about it. So today we're going to be talking about Kenneth Anderson. This is a master of arts. He's a book about how to change your drinking, a harm reduction guide to alcohol. So, Kenneth, welcome to the show. Sorry, it's a little weird when I'm overseas because the phones are kind of strange. I got to use my cell phone and time differential and things. But it's a pleasure that you are joining the show today.
Thank you for having me on your show, Dr. Kell.
Call me Michael, please.
Michael.
I'm not used to that doctor stuff. I mean, sometimes people go, sometimes they go, it's a long story, but I never like titles too much. But the way we used to do, there's no commercials, it's not really, it's just a chat. So you can share what you've learned, you know, working with, you know, people over the years about, you know, harm reduction and alcoholism and, you know, and anything else that's related to it. And you know, I mentioned your book a million times because unfortunately when I got over here, I could take so much stuff. And, so what I'd like to do, if there's a website people can go to and actually purchase the book, and so you make more money, that's my preference. Otherwise, I guess it's just, you know, you go to Alibris and Barnes & Noble and can't go to books anymore, and Amazon.com. Yes?
Yes, our book is called How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol, and we sell it through Amazon primarily. And you can go to our website, hamsnetwork.org, and hamsnetwork.org/book is where you'll get the information about the book. There's a lot of free information on the website, too. We are a support group that supports any positive change that people want to make in their drinking habits, from safer drinking to reduced drinking to quitting alcohol altogether. And I wanted to start with some statistics that the NIAAA has published. They published these in 2009 in the NIAAA Spectrum in an article called Alcoholism Isn't What It Used to Be. And everybody out here can Google this and look this up online. And what they found out is that for people with alcohol dependence, 75% of all people with alcohol dependence will eventually recover from this condition. And that 75% of those who recover will recover on their own without AA, without any specialized alcoholism treatment. Now, this is a study that covers 20 years, so it takes some people 20 years to recover this on their own. What these numbers tell us, if you do the math, it tells you that it's only about 20% of people with alcohol dependence that will actually seek out AA or some specialized alcoholism treatment. And our program is designed to address the other 80%. And what we do...
I haven't had a chance to see the new statistics, but because I know it's true with a lot of things, with substances that a lot of people just finally decide they don't want to do anymore. But, you know, in the statistics, I mean, do they actually group the people with the severity of the illness? You know, because I know it's like, you know, a lot of people, cause, you know, have problem, you know, there's problem drinkers, and then it's like people are truly addicted. Is there a distinction in those facts, or is it 75% pretty much across the board? And unless maybe there's a lot of secondary dual diagnoses or something, maybe.
These are all people that meet the DSM-4 criteria for alcohol dependence, which is what we used to call alcoholism. So these are people that are truly addicted.
Were they dual diagnosed, some of them too, or did they not go into that?
Yes, but they did not go into those numbers in this article that I'm citing. But yes, it's a mixture of everyone. It was a gigantic survey that was done by the NIAAA, which is the U.S. government. It's the National Institute on Health. And they did a giant survey, and the results, these were the results that they came up with.
Well, that's pretty good news, isn't it?
It is good news, although since some people take up to 20 years or a lifetime even to recover, there can be a lot of harms and damages in this period. One other thing I wanted to note is the people that get over alcohol dependence, roughly half of them do it by abstaining completely, and the other half do it by cutting back on their drinking, which is kind of surprising considering, you know, so many people tell us that this is a chronic disease that can only end in jails, institutions, and death, and that quitting is the only option. Actually, some people find that cutting back is their best option, about half, actually.
I guess Alan Marlatt was correct then, wasn't he, in the end?
Alan Marlatt was correct about many things. He has been a supporter of our program, and we were very happy. He's passed away recently, but we were very happy for his support. We've also got a lot of support from Pat Denning, who's also another expert in harm reduction in California. And we've been very happy for the support that they've given our program. Let me tell the people out there a little bit about harm reduction. Harm reduction is something that engages people in every positive change. And some people think they have the mistaken idea that harm reduction is opposed to abstinence, or it wants to encourage people to continue using drugs or alcohol. And that's not the case at all, because everybody that works in harm reduction sees quitting as a way to eliminate the harm. And we're totally supportive of anyone that chooses to quit and is successful. The difference between a harm reduction program and some of the more traditional programs is the traditional programs, some of them are very coercive and confrontational, and they say, you know, your only option is to quit. You have to do what we say, and you have to do our program, and you have no options, and you're an alcoholic, you're a loser, and your best thinking got you here, and you have no resources, you're powerless. And that's very much the opposite of harm reduction. And our program, which tries to encourage people to build on their inner strengths. Everyone has lots of inner strengths, and we try to bring them out and empower people rather than tell them that they are powerless. And we think that when we empower people, we give them lots of tools to help them to overcome their alcohol dependence, and we support them in choosing their own goal. And many people, the best way to engage them is to engage them in small steps. Now, some people, maybe they're ready to quit drinking and driving. They've decided drinking and driving is a really bad idea, but they don't want to change the amount they drink, so they want to make a new strategy where they won't have to drive anymore. And we are totally supportive of that. I mean, you can't go to an AA meeting and say, I want to give up drinking and driving.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear this, because I mean, I did like narcotics treatment for a long time, pain management, like probably up until like the years 2000. And yes, I'm a big supporter of methadone when it's done properly with, I guess, it's weird doing harm reduction too, because it's, you know, slowly. But I really never did like this sort of abusing the patients kind of thing, and you know, in 12-step. Although I did have found over the years, there are some people that really don't have a good locus of control inside, and they really do need, you know, some kind of external group to really stay focused. But I don't think it doesn't seem like it's the most common thing. I mean, most people actually probably have a good, you know, central locus of control. Needs to be reinforced, like you guys do.
Well, as I said, the numbers show about 20% of people will go for the the 12-step and the standard treatment and the AA meetings. And, of course, I'm totally supportive of the people that that works for. You know, if it's working for you to go to AA, that's great. And if you solve your problem that way, that's excellent. But that doesn't seem to help the majority of people with alcohol problems. They seem to need a different approach. One thing that we've learned from needle exchange, you know, if you open a needle exchange program in a community and just give people access to clean needles in a totally non-confrontational manner, I've been a volunteer in needle exchange programs. It's how I learned how to do harm reduction, was actually on the job training doing this needle exchange. And we find out that the incidence of AIDS and HIV in the community starts to drop just by making the needles available in a totally non-confrontational manner. We, you know, when people come in to turn in their used needles, we say, thank you for getting these off the street, and please always use clean ones. And you know, it's unconditional. We don't say, well, we'll give you some needles if you engage in this program or that program. That's been tried, and that doesn't work. The clients just stop showing up. But if you really thank them for bringing in the used needles and, you know, say thank you for always using clean needles, people get very encouraged, and very often, you know, after they've been going to the exchange for a few months or longer, some of them start saying, well, I'm interested in treatment. Maybe I should stop the heroin and get out of methadone maintenance. Maybe I should go into a regular treatment program and quit completely. You know, if you can engage people in small steps, they start wanting to make more changes on their own.
Yeah, what percentage of people do you find when you do a needle exchange? I mean, like, say, over a year, would actually start thinking about treatment?
I don't have the statistics offhand, so...
Like 10, 15% probably, you think? Would that be a reasonable number?
Probably. Probably that's a reasonable number. You know, I would be working there in the exchange, you know, exchanging needles, and I would have people ask me very often, maybe 1 out of 10 people that came in would say, can you give me some information about some treatment or about methadone or about buprenorphine, which is the newer one, the Suboxone. And, you know, people would, you know, I'd say about 1 in 10 people would be asking me for information about this.
And just for the listeners out there, I mean, Kenneth and I know this, but getting a 10% response rate in substance abuse over a year is like a really good thing, because it really adds up to after a while. So
it does.
And that's really good. So when did you leave, you know, Minneapolis and the needle exchange and go start doing the harm reduction in alcoholism?
Well, the Alcohol Harm Reduction Program was founded January of 2007. And before that time, I had been involved in a group called Moderation Management, which is about reduced and controlled drinking. And what I had found that there was a significant number of people there that they were really looking for a harm reduction program, and they weren't capable of staying with the moderation management limits, or they weren't ready for that yet, but they did want to make some positive changes. And so several of us left the moderation management program, which we were doing online, and in January 2007, we started something that was pure harm reduction. Instead of having, you know, specific drinking limits that you had to stick to, we just said any positive change that you can make is a good thing, whether you want to be safer, whether you want to cut back, if you want to get drunk one night a week instead of 5 nights a week, that's a big improvement. If you want to drink at home because you get in fights in bars, that's a big improvement. You know, if you can stop drinking and driving, that's a big improvement. So we started this program to get that segment of people that just really needed to engage in some small positive change, and they weren't ready for the really restrictive moderation limits there. And it's been a big success ever since. So this started in 2007. I was doing the needle exchange, I think, about the 2002 and 2003.
I mean, it's not good to do with alcoholism, but one thing I noticed that just taking care of medical patients, you know, I'm had addiction problems, it's just medical things. And, you know, it's funny, if you, you know, in their diet control, whatever it is, but if you can just find something that you know works, and I used to always give them, like, you know, niacin, I said, inositol, you know, to reduce their cholesterol, because almost everybody's cholesterol is too high, their HDL is too low. Mm-hmm. And tell them, don't you dare change anything. Just take these three pills. I'll give them to you for free, but you got to promise you'll take, you know, three a day for me when you come back, and I'm going to draw your blood, and I'm going to show you something really cool. You know, and so they come back, you know, and you show them their lab work, and you show that their HDL went up 50%, and their LDLs went down 40%. You know, and you can just see all of a sudden, like, they have life in their eyes because, you know, they finally did something that was successful. You know, and they have hope again.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
You know, and then you just add more stuff to it. You know, it works in everything. I guess your harm reduction works in everything. So it's a really good model, I think.
I think it really does because, you know, there are a few people that can make a big change all at once, but a lot of people aren't ready to make that big change. So if you can engage them in one small change, and then they're successful with that one small change, and they say, well, maybe I want to make another small change and another small change, and pretty soon they've gotten all the way to making that big change. I mean, quite a number of people that start our program and, you know, they just want to cut back a little bit on their drinking, or maybe they just want to be safer. And then after they've been engaged for a few months or a year, and suddenly they're saying, well, I want to quit completely because alcohol just isn't doing anything good in my life. Or they will reduce to really, you know, very moderate drinking levels. And so people can really make some big changes if they start with small changes first.
Because you find that, I mean, I would think that the people who, go through the program at the rate they need to until they get to a place where they think they've, you know, made a lot of good changes, you know, mm-hmm. where there's more to go or sort of irrelevant, but where they're finally kind of comfortable, but they really actually do have some power in their lives, I would think they would tend to become good advocates, you know, and for new patients and stuff. Is this true?
Yes, quite a few people feel comfortable about talking about harm reduction. Not everybody does. Not everybody wants to say, I used to have a problem with alcohol. So, you know, but some people do, and because it's been very successful for them. And one thing that we find in our program is people tend to move on, you know, when their problem is resolved, and they get a life, and they get engaged. And we don't tell our people that you have to keep coming to meetings for the rest of your life and you have to engage for the rest of your life, because that's not true. I mean, for most people, they get much better, and it's much healthier to go out and, you know, get a good job that's satisfying, do volunteer work, be engaged with your family, do all these things about having a life instead of, you know, just being involved in meetings forever. And we tell people, you know, if you start to slip up any and have any problem, you can come back right away. There's no judgment, you know, if you come back, you know. And so people that do have some slip-ups usually come back very quickly and get the things back under control again very quickly, and then they go back out and get engaged with life again.
So we found the same thing with, you know, with methadone patients, you know, when the staff was convinced they were ready, and you know, and they, you know, they just do a really slow detox, not to mess up the brain. And, you know, and they just said, like, yeah, you may never have a problem again, you may have a problem, but just don't wait too long because it makes it too much work for us. You know, just come back or call us up. If you, you know, you may only need some counseling. You know, you need to talk to somebody. You know, we're going to charge you. Just get your butt back here. You know, and for them to know that makes a really big difference on those addictive patients.
Absolutely.
And trust in the people, I think, you know.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about about our program. And our program has 17 elements, and we call them elements and not steps because they are all optional and they can be done in any order. And the first element in our program is to do a cost-benefit analysis of your drinking. And this is taking four sheets of paper, and on one you write down the positives of your current drinking habits. On the other, you write down the negatives, the cons of your current drinking habits. And then on the third, you write down the pros, the positives of your proposed change. And on the fourth, you write down the negatives, the cons of your proposed change. And, you know, some people say, you write down the positives of your current drinking habits, you know, shouldn't you just write down everything negative? But actually, that strategy of just writing down all the bad things doesn't work because there always are good things, you know, or people wouldn't drink at all. There are some good things. And you have to be consciously aware of them. If you put them in your subconscious, first of all, They'll just sneak up on you when you're not thinking, and you will have a relapse and go back to your old behavior. So you have to be aware of, you know, the good things. The other thing is, if you're aware of the good things, for example, if alcohol, use alcohol to help you relax, then you can start thinking, well, what are some other ways I can think of to relax that don't, you know, involve alcohol? Can I exercise? Can I do yoga? Can I do meditation? You know, what will work instead of alcohol to give me this positive benefit? You know, and the same, you know, if you use it because you have social phobia, maybe you want to join Toastmasters and start practicing public speaking so you won't be so afraid of talking to people anymore. But, you know, you need to learn new ways to replace the positives that you got from alcohol, and you have to be aware of them to do that. So it's really important to write down the positives of why you drink as well as the negatives. And then, you know, suppose your goal is to quit. You write down the positives of quitting and the negatives of quitting. And this is a really helpful tool that's been researched a lot. Sometimes it's called a decisional balance sheet. Sometimes it's called a cost-benefit analysis. But it's been researched a lot. It's helpful in all sorts of situations where you want to make a change in your life. And this is our first element.
I'm curious because I remember reading about decision matrices and things in my life and stuff a long time ago. And, you know, and how people are always like supposed to relapse if you actually keep testing them. You can tell it's going to be coming up. But do your clients, I mean, after a while, I mean, just occasionally just do one, just, you know, for, just to see where they are, kind of as a barometer of how they're doing. Because, I mean, there's always a lot of denial going on for all mm-hmm. this stuff, I think.
We encourage people to do these periodically because they find that their reasons for drinking change and their reasons for not drinking change, and you know, or their reasons for, you know, drinking less or drinking safer, you know, they change over time. And so you will get a different one, you know, 6 months down the road. So we encourage people to do them periodically, and people look back and say, wow, I've really changed in my attitudes now. And they really surprise themselves sometimes.
I mean, it sounds like, I thought it was a great tool. I'm glad to see they're still using it. So you have decision matrices, and so tell me some more of the stuff that you guys all do.
Well, one thing that's very important that we encourage most people to do is to chart their drinking. And this means to use a calendar or a worksheet of some sort. We have worksheets on the book and also on the website that you can print out from the website for free. Or you could just use a calendar and write down the number of drinks that you have on a given day. And for this, it's very important to learn how to measure a standard drink. A standard drink is one 12-ounce beer at 5% alcohol, or a 5-ounce glass of wine at 12% alcohol, or a 1.5-ounce shot of hard liquor at 40% 80-proof alcohol. These are what constitutes a standard drink. They all contain the same amount of alcohol, and we encourage people to write down the number of standard drinks that they consume each day on a calendar and track. And if you don't drink at all, just write down a zero. And many people find that the act of tracking their drinks in and of itself helps them to cut down because they're just being very aware and they're counting. Some people, if they're in bars, they save bottle caps from their beers so that they can count. Some people save swizzle sticks. If you drink in bars, you have to be very careful because many of these bar drinks can have 3 drinks or 5 drinks or 6 drinks of alcohol in them, so you have to kind of estimate and not just say, well, it's a drink is a drink. You know, you have to measure in standard drinks. But people find that the act of tracking can really help them be consciously aware, and it just makes them cut down without even trying. They can also use the calendar to plan. They might want to write down the number of drinks that they plan to have on Sunday, the number they plan to have on Monday. If they plan to abstain, they can write down a zero for that day. And planning ahead is another good way to cut down. And people that want to get more elaborate, they can write down what kind of mood they were in the day that they were drinking and various additional information. Some people want to keep track of how much money that they're spending on their alcohol. They can write this down too. I also use these charts when I was quitting smoking because I cut back gradually. I also use Chantix, but I cut back gradually, and I finally, after 40 days, I got down to 2 cigarettes a day, and then I quit. So they can be very useful for changing any bad habit.
Yeah, Okay, have you, you know, because, I mean, you know, philosophers and Gurdjieff and, you know, psychiatrists talking about learning to pay attention, because everybody's so automatic, which is part of the problem, because you don't pay attention, you don't really, you can't really control what you're doing. So have you found that, you know, when it, like, you know, when they start dealing with alcoholism or even, you know, cigarette smoking, and you actually have those little tracking sheets you do, and, you know, you decision matrix enough times so people sort of get an idea to, you know, look at their feelings and stuff and what the drivers are. Have you found that it tends to generalize in life, that they actually, as they practice more, they actually become more attentive and more awake to what's going on around them in general?
I think it can help them because, you know, people can extend these tools to any aspect of their life. I mean, I try to practice harm reduction in everything that I do. You know, reducing risk is a good idea, whatever you're going to do. You can't really get rid of risk completely unless you choose to live in a padded room and, you know, just eat oatmeal and, you know, and basically...
You can probably aspirate, you know.
Well, I think I'd want to kill myself after a while of living this totally risk-free life, you know. You want to go out and associate people, and, you know, if you're actually going to live life, there will be some risks, but how can you minimize them? Well, you know, maximizing the benefits and minimize the risks is, you know, that's the whole thing that harm reduction is all about, because, you know, you can't get rid of all risks. So some people choose to abstain from things because there's too many risks. I, myself, fortunately, I'm in New York City, so I can abstain from driving an automobile very easily. I can take subway, lots of good public transportation, and I choose abstinence from driving an automobile, personally. So that's a way for me to reduce the risk. Other people, you know, they need to drive, they really can't get away without driving, and they can use a seatbelt to reduce their risk. It's a harm reduction device, just like a clean needle is a harm reduction device for people that are shooting drugs.
Going on, like, you know, you've been working on a long time, and Alan Marlott and those guys have been working on it for years and years. Are you finding out that people, that, you know, the doctors and the treatment providers starting to catch on with this finally a little more?
Yes, finally. I'm on LinkedIn a lot and talking with my colleagues there and with professionals there. And many, many of them are saying, yeah, we're starting to incorporate harm reduction in our practice now. We're finding that, you know, that we can engage a lot of people in small steps that we weren't able to engage before when we had this black and white absolute programs of, you know, abstinence or abstinence only, or, you know, drink yourself to death. You know, these are the only options. And so more and more people are starting to catch on, and I think it's going to be very big very soon, because people are finding that it is working to engage a population, a large population, that was not engaged before.
Well, it's about time. I mean, medicine should be cheaper. You know, it's funny because you look everywhere. I mean, you look at weight reduction, you know, and, you know, a good weight reduction doctor would tell you, you know, you come in, they say, what's your goal? I'm out. Some of you are, of course, but the goal is your goal. My goal for you is to get you down to somewhere between 5% and 10% weight loss, then keep you there for 6 months, you know, see how you do. Mm-hmm. Your body used to it, and then go down some more. You know, mm-hmm. And you go, but if we get you down 10%, 5 to 10%, you know, that is a great increase in your, a great decrease in your risks for being obese, you know, right away.
And, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Small steps can lead to big changes, as we said in the title of the show here. Well, we have some other elements here that I can talk about a little more. We have 17 elements in the program, and I'm not going in order now. One of them we have is to learn about risk ranking and to rank your risks, because we find that harm is in a hierarchy and some things are more harmful than others. Generally, drinking and driving has a lot more risk involved than drinking and dialing, making drunken phone calls, unless you call your boss and, you know, chew him out, you know. That can be pretty risky. Calling your friends is not so bad, probably. So, but we encourage people, you know, to actually, we have a worksheet where people can write out their risky behaviors and rank them 1 to 4, you know, 4 is the most risky ones, and then say, okay, what kind of plan can I make to get rid of the worst behaviors, avoid the worst behaviors first? And that's one thing. Because it's very important to recognize, you know, not all risks are equal. Some are much worse than others. Another one of the elements that we have is to deal with outside issues that affect drinking. And I think this is a really big one. There are many, many outside issues that can affect drinking. One of the biggest outside issues are mental health issues. People that have issues with depression or anxiety or panic attacks, social phobia, other mental health issues like this. Many people drink to self-medicate these issues, and they find really that it's not really a good way to treat the issues, and there are better ways out there to treat them. So we encourage people to learn about things like cognitive behavioral therapy or rationally motive therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, and use these tools to address their problems like anxiety and depression. And, you know, some people can do this with a self-help book, like Feeling Good is a really good one that I like to recommend to people. Some people need more than a book, and they might want to go to a therapist, and, you know, and if a therapist doesn't help, you know, medications are also an option, although I recommend people to be cautious about medications, and don't use that as your first line of defense. That's like the last line of defense.
Well, that's what I found, too, is, I mean, even with methadone, I mean, the reason we used to get methadone was, I mean, it's like 20 years advanced, that they'd, like, get pissed off. You know, so the one word I can say is truly biological in some people is narcotics addiction, because I know your brain makes endorphins. And, mm-hmm. you know, like 20 years later, then Alan Leshner said, oh, yeah, Dr. Kell was right 20 years ago. I go, that's terrible being advanced, but it's nice to finally figure it out, you know, and tell patients that, you know, we just give you the medicine that, so your brain can accept the therapy, you know, whatever you need, you know, whatever kind of social counseling you need, your jobs, or learn how to be sign and social, you know. But if you don't have the medicine, you're not going to do it. You know, it's right out of front. We tried to explain that to them, like you guys do, which I think made a big difference on our long-term, you know, abstinence rate. Because probably in 3 years, you know, half the patients, you know, could get off methadone, you know, for chronic pain, their pain would resolve. You know, a few of them do so well on it, they don't want to ever get off it because they're afraid that something bad's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good reason. You know, that's good harm reduction, right?
It is.
Don't take a chance.
Absolutely.
So, I'm really pleased with you.
Thank you.
And your work. That sounds funny, but I am. You're making me feel warm. So things are finally moving along. You know, irrationally, finally.
And there are also other outside issues that do affect drinking. And, you know, there are things like financial issues. You know, when people are poor, they often drink more because, you know, they're just unhappy because they don't have enough money to survive with. And it doesn't help to spend the money on alcohol, but, you know, it's a really cheap way to kill your sorrows. And a lot of people do because they don't have adequate income, they don't have proper employment. So we really encourage people, you know, to work on their financial health too. You know, we can't resolve these outside issues for people, but we can support them. And we let people talk about all these outside issues in our support groups, you know, their mental health issues, financial health issues. You know, some people have sexual issues, you know, they're not getting any sex, and it's making them unhappy, and they're drinking, you know, as a substitute. You know, it's like we encourage people.
And social
issues. Yeah. Some people are very lonely. They don't have friends. And, you know, it's like, what can you do to, you know, start making more friends so you're not so lonely? You don't have to rely on alcohol to eliminate your loneliness. I like Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, because it's really not about, you know, taking advantage of people. It's about, you know, it's about relating to people in a healthy fashion. He talks about, you know, don't talk about yourself all the time. Ask the other person about, you know, themselves. And this is one of my worst habits I had throughout most of my life, is I would want to impress people by telling them what a great person I was. And this was not really attractive to other people. They didn't want to hear that. They wanted me to ask them, you know, tell me about yourself. What do you do? And, you know, it took me, you know, until I was in my 40s to learn how to do this when I read Dale Carnegie's book. And it was like, oh, Well, that makes sense. Let me start practicing this. This is one I did for myself that was really helpful for me to engage people more, to make more friends, to be less lonely. Now I have lots of friends because, you know, I don't sound like I'm a totally self-involved, arrogant person, which was not my intent, but that's how I came off to people.
No matter how interesting your life is, other people's lives, even if they seem mundane, you know, to everybody else, actually are really interesting when you listen to them.
They are.
This is a therapist, because you start seeing all the factors work together, and it's actually an amazing kaleidoscope of things. You know?
Absolutely. You know, and he says, listen with genuine interest, and, you know, people, everybody has interesting things to say. So it's not difficult to listen with genuine interest. You know, you're not faking it. You're being very genuine because everyone has something interesting to say if you just ask them.
So you probably did like 5 million things. So what are some more of them?
Some of the other things, we encourage people to learn how to have fun without alcohol, because very often people have all their fun engaged with, you know, alcohol. And we say, you know, what are some fun things that you can do without alcohol? What are some fun things that are incompatible with alcohol? I like the New York Times crossword. That's really hard to do when you're, you know, half drunk out of your mind. It's hard to do when you're completely sober, you know. That was one of my favorites to do. Some people like knitting. They like to go dancing. There's all kinds of hobbies and things. So we can encourage people to make a list of fun things that you can do without alcohol. And we also encourage people to find alternative coping mechanisms. So when you're upset, you know, or when things go bad in life, are you going to run home and open up the bottle and drink? Or what else can you do? Can you go to the gym and exercise? Can you do yoga? Can you do meditation? Can you read a book? Can you go to a movie? Just make a list of alternative coping mechanisms so that you don't have to rely on the alcohol, you know, to cope when things go wrong in your life. And
okay, I think you use like, I'm sure you use like, different things for different people, but, you know, like some of this mindfulness training, you know, that Gavin Zinn does, or, you know, hypnosis with the cognitive behavior stuff. It depends on the therapist, but they like.
I'm very interested in the mindfulness stuff because I've heard my colleagues talking about it so much recently, and I just got a book a couple days ago on mindfulness, and I want to look at that in depth. I haven't looked at it, but it looks, I mean, so many of my colleagues and friends are recommending this and saying how much it works, and I really want to look at this in depth and write some articles on our website about it and put it, when we do a new edition of the book in a few years, I want to have a chapter on mindfulness in the book because it looks like it's really good stuff.
I think, I mean, a lot of things, except you're not teaching with Vipassana probably, but, by having people pay attention and keep the, list of things in practice. I mean, it's a way of being mindful, paying attention to what you're doing. So you're probably actually doing a lot of mindfulness training already. But it's like with many things, things get associated with a certain protocol. Mm-hmm. And then everybody sort of thinks this is the protocol. It's like the name is magic. And we actually look at different ways people do stuff. Yeah, it's actually the same. Even like the Christian contemplative stuff versus Kabbalistic stuff versus, Vipassana, meditation. You go, use different words, but they're sort of like all doing the same thing. All the same, So I think you'll be impressed with your work when you read it. Mm-hmm. Because it's pretty good. It sort of feels to some people that kind of, the name and stuff.
Yes, I think so. One more of the elements that we have. I think you can hear the lullaby of New York in the background here. Element that we have is using alcohol-free time and having some days that you don't drink. And for a lot of people that have been drinking every day, having just one day that they don't drink anything can be such a major achievement. So we encourage people, start with just one day. Of course, some people who've been drinking heavily might have withdrawal. So we do tell people, to be very careful about withdrawal if you're in that danger range of people that have been drinking, you know, a pint or more of booze for, you know, years on end, you know, or a quart or more, or a quart for, you know, even weeks. You know, if you're going to have some withdrawal, you do need to either taper off using alcohol itself, or you need to get some medications from your doctor, like Librium or Valium, to help you taper down, or you need to check into a detox program. But many people aren't drinking at the level that they will have physical withdrawal, and they can quit for a day. And we so much encourage people, you know, if you haven't had a day off in a long time from drinking alcohol, do one day just to show that you can do it. And when people can do one day, then they find, you know, wow, I did that. Now, next week, maybe I can do 2 days. And people gradually add in more non-drinking days. And some people will say, well, I want to quit for a month. And, you know, then I can encounter all kinds of different experiences without any alcohol in my system and learn how to turn down drinks and learn my drink refusal strategies and using alcohol-free time, you know, to change your habits is a really good way. And it's like we're telling people, you don't have to quit forever, but, you know, just quit for a day or quit for a week, quit for a month, you know, whatever's comfortable for you. And, you know, gradually exercise your muscles that you can abstain for longer periods of time. And people find this a really helpful tool in changing their habits.
Good point. I think the word forever and the word never are extremely dangerous words.
Yes.
Because they put expectations in people's heads that they're not ready for. And so it's really nice just to let them, you know, do stuff. But it's nice with alcohol because they're keeping track of it. You know, they can't come back and I guess they say, I couldn't make it for a day. And you go, well, let's just try having like half the drinks on Sunday then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, they know about withdrawal. You know, if they've been drinking for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you feel bad withdrawal, go have a drink. It's a logical thing to do. But you don't necessarily have to have two. You know, be wise.
Yeah, we have a chapter. We have a section in the book about tapering down, and some people can use a taper very successfully to get off the alcohol without having any withdrawals, because alcohol suppresses the withdrawal symptoms. So some people find that they're in good control. They can cut back half, you know, each day until they get down to zero. So some people have a hard time doing the taper. They find it very difficult to control. And we say if you're having too much of a hard time to taper off using alcohol, you know, go to your doctor, get the medications, or check into the detox program to detox you safely. Withdrawal is something that some people who have been drinking very heavily do have to worry about. It's major alcohol withdrawal is quite deadly. It's one of the most dangerous types of withdrawal there is. It can lead to heart attacks and strokes and death to about 1 in 4 people.
Shakes and fits and whatever. Shakes, and fits, I guess. I mean, yes. You love those sayings. But, even though I know that, you know, 12-step, you know, came out of a different era, a different time, and, you know, as long as people go to the meetings and, you know, do what they do and start getting involved, helping everybody else, it seems to work pretty well. And sometimes it seems that actually it doesn't have as much harm effect on the psyche as you would think. Because I kind of like a lot of narcotics users, especially kids, they get into it. I don't mean just popping a few pills, but getting into heroin and stuff, especially middle class kids. They have a lot of issues with shame. You know, mm-hmm. And you know, this program's a good program. We talk a lot about that, you know, and self-worth. Which I think, you know, some people, you know, that's really, really an issue. So, I mean, I'm sort of convinced that for a lot of young, I don't know about alcohol, but at least narcotics users, can't say cocaine, because cocaine is sort of a different kind of drug, but a lot of just have really bad shame issues. You know, and so, you know, it seems like there'd be a place for, you know, maybe some people to start out in a more harsh program, so to speak. You know, and I say, you know, maybe been absent for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, because treatment of heroin is probably not something we should do on a general basis anyway, even sporadically. Compared to alcohol, it seems like it would be a good thing to get them into harm reduction just to help them with the rest of their life. You know, and try to bring some of the control back into their own, you know, their own sphere instead of having to be totally dependent on the group. Is people working on that? Are you guys looking at that? Or
we have... We have an online group for drug users. It's separate from the drinkers group. It's an online email group where the drug users can come and talk about doing harm reduction for their drugs. I initially wanted to have everybody in the same group, but the drug users themselves said, we like our own separate group, please. So I accommodated them, and so we have a drug users online support group besides our alcohol drinkers online support group, which you can find from our homepage, or you can Google drugs-HR or drugs-HR, and you'll find it. In addition to that, for a long time, many years, places like the Harm Reduction Therapy Center in California, in San Francisco and Oakland, which is operated by Pat Denning and some of her colleagues, they've had drop-in groups for drug users and for homeless people and for people with mental health issues, which are totally harm reduction-based groups. And Jeannie Little's written an article about this. It's in Andrew Tatarsky's book, Harm Reduction Psychotherapy. It's a great article about how to run a harm reduction group for drug users and homeless people. And she talks about how when one person fell asleep in the group, what she did was, you know, to get him a pillow because she figured he had been out on the street and what he needed most at this time was actually a chance to sleep in a safe place. So it wasn't like, wake up and pay attention to what we're saying. It's like, it's okay. If you need to sleep, then you can sleep. And it's really meeting people where they are at.
I mean, it's I know the government loves to spend money on high-tech stuff, and there's a lot of pressure from the big corporations to keep the money flowing, you know, from them to the people back to them. You know, if the government, I mean, I know they're paying for research and stuff, but paying for research is one thing, you know, and there's a lot of good research, but if it doesn't make it out of the field or it doesn't get used, who cares? It's just basically a waste of time. So, is NIDA and, you know, the alcohol guys in NIH actually trying to get more proactive, you know, kind of get outside the regular boundaries to, you know, actually, you know, to really support this, you know, that it is a much less expensive way to provide medicine, you know, because you can do it earlier and you can do it later too, you know, and I'm just curious, how much.
I haven't seen the government agencies in the United States move in this direction yet. I mean, there's so much inertia in government agencies. They're usually the last people to move. What we're seeing right now is more and more therapists out there and treatment providers. They are incorporating this into their programs, you know, because they're seeing that it's useful. It's engaging people that weren't engaged before. And so lots of people in private practice, they are bringing this into their programs, and that's where we see it coming from.
That's the best place, actually, probably long term. But I think we're about running out of time, Kenneth. So if people go to HTTP, you know, hamsnetwork.org, is that the overall place for all of your things, your drugs and everything and alcohol?
Yes, you can get to everything from hamsnetwork.org.
Okay, and so for those who, you know, by the way, these shows are all archived MP3s. It's got a day to get them on the site, and you're free to use them wherever you want to use them for. There's you don't need to do nothing. They're just given away. So if you like your interview, you can keep it. If you don't like it, you don't have to tell anybody about it. So we've been talking with Kenneth Anderson, who's the author of the book, How to Change Drinking, Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. I would recommend if you look at the book. I've looked at it. I like it. It's very straightforward and to the point, and it really does work. And again, I'm encouraged that you guys, people have followed through this after all these years and are actually getting some really good, unequivocal positive results. So I want to thank you very much.
And, thank you for having me on your show.
You're welcome, and take care, and best to you, and just call us up sometime in the future when you have some great new things to share. And
okay.
We'll see what we can do. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining Dr. Michael John Kell on Mind, Brain, and Body. Please tune in next Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time for another edition of Mind, Brain, and Body, right here on Voice America Health and Wellness.